Well, hello everybody. It's David Leese here. I'm your proud host of Leaders on the Frontier. It's February the 29th, 2024, the year of our Lord. And today we're going to talk about the law. And it's it goes without saying there's a lot going on when it comes to the law these days. And so I'm delighted to have with us our friend, colleague, Professor Bruce Pardee. Bruce, a warm welcome to you.
Thank you, David. Always great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you, Bruce. It's almost our heads are spinning, as you say, when it comes to the myriad of issues that we're facing today. We're going to talk a lot about issues that I think will concern you, our audience. So I want to warmly welcome not only Bruce Pardee, but also our guests, our audience. On X as well as on YouTube, and we welcome your questions and your comments. We'd be keen to hear from you, because today we're talking about a couple key issues that have really appeared just the last while, but are really in keeping with a trend, and we'll get to that in a moment. That of course Bruce speaks so well of. We want to talk about the recent tabling of legislation regarding online censorship. So this is a biggie. This is a profound issue, and I really urge everyone to pay attention on this one. And then we have the audacity to also talk about a scheme that has come up, very interesting story about it, around, quote, co-management, changes to the Land Act within British Columbia, that great province, that would, in effect, many would argue, that would give a veto over development over Crown land. So that's a key issue. And I think we'll also get to some other ones, time permitting, as we look at, golly, the state of the RCMP. They seem to be reluctant to be able to interview key parties involved in corruption scandals. They don't seem to know where the Prime Minister's office is in Parliament Hill. It's really kind of befuddling, Bruce. So we may even get to that, among others. But there's really, truly a lot to discuss here. So I want to dive into the first issue, Bruce, and you've written about it so well. You've talked about, of course, the online censorship bill. So you may recall that last year, the federal government came forward with an initial version, and there was a lot of reaction to that, saying that was a full-fronted attack on freedom of speech. And so this is a different one. It's kind of, or is it different? Is it still a sheep within wolves? Sorry, I'm mixing up my metaphors here, but is it a sheep in wolves clothing or vice versa? What does this online act mean to you, Bruce? What's your analysis?
Well, it looks to me to be a wolf without the sheep's clothing. I mean, on its face, it's extraordinary. So it basically divides up into four parts, and the first part is the regulation of online platforms. So it's the relationship between the government and Facebook or Twitter or X or YouTube or whoever is sort of running the show in terms of hosting what people are saying. That's probably the least offensive bit. It's still problematic because it is giving to the administration the power to make the rules. And so what they're setting up to happen is that the online platforms will be empowered and required to censor us. But this is not even the worst part of the bill. There are other parts. And the second part are amendments to the criminal code, which is not about the online platforms. It's about the government and you. And the government proposes to create offenses that are extraordinary, both in their description and in their penalty. And perhaps we can go through that in a little bit of detail. But the third and perhaps most concerning part, I mean, the criminal code provisions are extraordinary, as I say, but the one that is going to cause the broadest difficulty, I think, is the third part, which is changes to the Canadian Human Rights Act. And that they intend to create And it's reminiscent of the one that used to be in there, Section 13. This is Section 13 again. Basically making it unlawful to discriminate in your speech and to empower people to complain to the tribunal, to the commission, easily without, you know, any costs and without having to give up their identity to the person they're complaining about. It is going to make it extraordinarily easy for anyone to complain about anything that you say online. So if there's somebody that they want to target, this is basically the woke mob unleashed in terms of empowering, putting cancel culture on steroids. Because in order to defend yourself, many of these complaints, I mean, some of them will be, it doesn't look to be that difficult to be successful, but even if they weren't successful, just the fact of having a complaint lodged against you means that you need to lawyer up and face all the time and costs, consequences of having to deal with the complaint. And then if you happen to be unsuccessful in defending yourself, then there are penalties. You might end up having to pay the complainant $20,000 and the government, for that matter, $50,000. So,
wow.
So on a number of occasions in the past, I have said something like, when they tell you who they are and what they intend to do, you should believe them.
Exactly.
And this is a straight up indication about what they are and what they intend to do. And it's not hidden. It's plain on the face of the draft bill. So there you go.
Wow. Okay, so everybody, I'm talking with Professor Bruce Pardee. He's the executive director of Rights Probe, and he's at Queen's University, and he's giving his analysis about Bill C-63. So look it up, pay attention, open your eyes while we can see what is going on here. But this is a game-changing piece of legislation. Our government is no longer there, Bruce, upholding rights regarded to freedom of speech, among others, but they're in the forefront of destroying them. That's how I read this. Is that a fair comment?
Sure, absolutely. But, you know, in a way, that reflects quite accurately where we're at. And we've been here for a while now. So we might ask in the broad sense, well, how do we get here? Why is this happening?
Yeah.
And I think in part it's because our system of law does not now operate on the collection of principles that we all have in our head. At some point along the way, there was a quiet revolution or a paradigm shift, if you like, from one set of ideas to another. And that's been going on for a long time. And, you know, it's never actually fully complete, but one of the changes is that we have shifted from a system in which the rule of law is paramount and individual freedoms are paramount into a system of rule by law, as in, now government is using law as a tool or even indeed a weapon, not to protect your freedoms, but to manage you. That's what they think their job is now. The job of the government is to manage the population using law as a tool. And this act is just an extreme example of that trend.
Yeah, no, I think you're onto something, Bruce. So this is a larger strategic point here that I really hope that people don't miss. And you're alluding to something that's very interesting. You're basically wading into territory, using the law as a weapon to really manage people's ways of thinking, to say, no, this, you can't talk about this, or you're going to enable third-party actors to weigh and say, well, I think that Bruce, I'm really concerned, and I anticipate that he's going to talk about things that I don't want to hear about. So what I find fascinating, and you've got to read Bill 6, C-63.
Is you really do. You really have to read it. Element. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's extraordinary. You just read it. You know what? I can just read out one of the little bits that might make people go, this is one of the new sections of the criminal code that they're proposing. It goes like this. Mm-hmm. Everyone who commits an offense under this act, and by this act, they mean the criminal code. So just for a moment, let's just consider the kinds of offenses that exist under the criminal code. There are extreme offenses like murder, and there are not so serious offenses like, you know, mischief or theft. I don't want to underplay theft, but theft is not murder. Mm-hmm. Right? No, let me carry on. Everyone who commits an offense, any offense, whether it's murder or mischief, under this act, if the commission of the offense is motivated by hatred based on race, national or ethnic origin, language, color, religion, sex, age, mental or physical disability, sexual orientation, or gender identity of expression. These are the normal list of prohibited grounds of discrimination. Here's the kicker. Everyone who commits an offense under this act is guilty of an indictable offense and liable to imprisonment for life.
Wow. Life.
If you commit the crime of mischief and you are motivated by hatred on a prohibited ground, you can be thrown in prison for life.
And who the heck is the judge of this, Bruce?
Well, the judge. The judge is going to be the judge of that. And as we have seen over a period of time, our courts give varying definitions of what kind of situation might fall into the bucket of hateful, which is part of the problem here. So you have the sword of Damocles hanging over you, and the danger is that everybody will need to manage their speech so as not to run into this problem. And therefore, you end up with a country in which people are not free to speak.
Okay, but just to be clear, there's also this pre-crime within the act. So
yes.
if I'm a party, I can weigh in and say, you may incite hatred or some type of offense, and you can then start getting a judge to lock you down. You can put a curfew on another person. You can fine them. You can say you've got to be isolated from any contact from others.
Yes,
I'm not being dramatic or
hysterical. No, you're not. On this. You are not. There's a provision that does just this. People may have seen the movie, the Tom Cruise movie called Minority Report. And in that movie, it's a futuristic time, and people are imprisoned for what they call pre-crime. That is crime they haven't committed yet.
Wow.
That, more or less, is what is contemplated here. There's a provision that would allow, for example, house arrest on the grounds that they think that you're going to commit one of these crimes.
Okay, so this is a full-throated legal assault on freedom of speech and things that we take for granted. Like, this has arrived now. This is 1984, period.
I don't think that's overstating it. Yes, and so if I can go on, I don't know. So I mentioned the proposed amendment to the Canadian Human Rights Act. I'll just read that very quickly, if you like. Mm-hmm. It is a discriminatory practice to communicate hate speech, that is speech that nobody knows what it means, by means of the internet or any other means of communication, telecommunication, in a context in which the hate speech is likely to foment detestation or vilification of an individual or group of individuals on the basis of a prohibited ground. So, in other words, if you express your opinion about, pick something that's controversial, that's in the news and it's being debated, let's say transgenderism. You state your opinion that you don't think that transgender women are men, for example. Well, you do not know that you're not going to end up with a complaint against you on the basis of that section, having to try to defend yourself from being fined and censored.
Wow. So you could just talk about biological male-female, and you disagree with the cultural Marxist postmodern twisted view around gender fluidity or like queer theory, like all the whole.
The problem is we don't know, right? The problem is that this is open-ended. It's not very well defined. We don't know. It's set up so that the answer to that is maybe.
Okay. But to be clear, this is opening totally new ground in the whole regulation speech. Well, okay, so I remember, actually, that's not true. We remember Mao, remember Stalin, remember Hitler. Like, well, but it's all in keeping with totalitarian regimes, is it not?
Well, that's true, but the thing is, that is absolutely correct. But we shouldn't forget that this threshold has really already been crossed in this country as well. So we used to have an old Section 13, much like this one, in the Canadian Human Rights Act, but we also have other sections. So for example, in the BC Human Rights Code,
yes,
there's a prohibition on speech that discriminates, much like this one. And that one has been there for a while. It hasn't been struck down, and people are just going along with it. And the more you put up with, the fact that the population in this country has not said enough, this is too far. We have already sort of crossed that threshold before, and now we're getting it full blown more and again.
Okay, so not to use a phrase that's used a lot, but we remember when Caesar came back to Rome and crossed the Rubicon.
Right.
This is the Rubicon. This is if it quacks like a duck, walks like a duck, this is a duck, right?
Right.
This is it.
Oh yeah. Sure.
Wow. So what are we going to do about this, Bruce? This is where people have to stand up and be counted. You got to call your representatives if you care about it. Speak up. Tell us your opinion, audience. Please get engaged here. This is not the time to be silent. This is the time to speak up. Is this not good advice, Bruce?
Oh well, we're absolutely. Listen, it's already very late. It's already very late. But yes, yeah. I mean, if we were to accept this, then we will accept anything.
Yeah. No. So this is it. So, and Bruce, in all fairness to you, you have been in your leadership role, among others, speaking about this for years, raising the red flag. I know this. In fact, you spoke eloquently about in our past conversations the rise of the administrative state. Is this kind of what this is? Is this just like giving our rights right to the administrative state rather than the nesting it within the individual, the individuals and community? This is saying the administrative state's going to be in charge.
Yes, and that aspect of it is most visible, I think, in this bill, in that first part where they are going to regulate the internet providers. But and the criminal code is going to be in the actual statute, as is the amendment to the Human Rights Act. But yes, so what you have here is you have government deciding to put in place tools to manage people's behavior and to manage their thinking. If we were actually living in a free country, let's put it this way. If you were living in a free country, free people are allowed to hate each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's part of being human. And if you do, and you are free, then you're allowed to say that you do. I mean, I'm not endorsing it. It's just one of the facts of being human, right? So the fact that you are not allowed to do that means you are being managed. In the United States, they have a First Amendment, which provides them with freedom of speech. And the U.S. courts over time have said that speech, which in this country might qualify as hate speech, in the United States is protected speech. Mm-hmm. Now, their jurisprudence on freedom of speech is not perfect either.
Right.
But it's more robust than we have in this country. We think that we have freedom of speech because it says so in our charter. Mm-hmm. But there's a myth to that, right? Just because words appear in a charter doesn't mean that they're true, because those words, especially when they're stated in a very vague way, as this one is. What those words mean is up to our courts. And our courts have said over time that freedom of speech in the charter does not mean that we can't have sections like the one I referred to from the BC Human Rights Act or others that have the effect of making, we have an existing hate speech provision in our criminal code already today. That's not part of this bill. If for my money, if we took freedom of speech seriously, we wouldn't have that provision in the criminal code. So we're already behind the eight
ball. Wow. Gosh, so this is a tough situation. So we've really got to turn this around and speak up. You know, what I find also so painfully ironic about this is that we've got leaders in our country that have pranced around the past and wore blackface and all kinds of stuff to make, you know, like people do stupid things. So that's sure. All under question too. I mean, that's offensive and racism. You know, so this is really walking a new territory that only regimes before us. I think John Locke, I'm a big fan of John Locke, of course, he would be rolling in his grave as he talks about this is tyranny.
Yes, and we should also observe that, and this has been the trend for a while as well, that these things tend to travel in one direction only, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're Justin Trudeau and you've worn blackface, you know, no problem. But if you're somebody else on the other side of the aisle and you do something that's not nearly, quote, as bad as that, well, then you're going to be in the hot water.
Exactly.
Right. So we've lost one of the other ideas that we've lost, and we've lost a lot of ideas. But one of the ideas that we've lost is that the law should be even-handed and disinterested. It shouldn't care who you are, doesn't care what your ideology is, doesn't care what your politics is, doesn't care what your party is. It is disinterested, dispassionate, and even-handed and blind. That idea does not seem to be very popular anymore.
Wow. So the whole image, and you see this iconic image in all kinds of architecture, of Lady Justice standing there with the scales of justice, but blindfolded, is not in vogue anymore.
Is that not in vogue anymore. It doesn't seem to be, both in this country or the United States. We can see what's happening in the U.S., where the law has been politically weaponized. And so their version of this is different than ours. But you can see the thing crumbling right before your eyes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is lawfare then. Lawfare, yes. The art of using law to not just slander your opponent, but to put them in jail, right?
Yes. Now, to what extent and how frequently this criminal code provision might end up being used, who knows? And it might be quite rare. The existing hate speech provision in the criminal code is rarely used.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but its mere existence is significant. Right, because it establishes what the line in the sand is, and it creates a chilling effect. You live in a country in which you are not allowed to do certain things.
Exactly, and I think that chilling effect is very important, Bruce. Because I recall what was it just 3 months ago? There was a survey that came out in the United States where some 80% of people now think pretty carefully before they speak about some type of subject. I don't know exactly what the numbers would be for Canada. I suspect it would be the same, if not higher. Mm-hmm. But this is a problem. We need healthy debate and discussion where we can vigorously disagree on something, and we may even be offended. That's okay. That's in keeping with a brilliant tradition of innovation. So it's not just simply the flow of ideas as we seek truth, but also for prosperity. And I think this has been shown again. So this is a foundational element. If you do not have freedom of speech, you do not have a free and democratic society, period.
Yes, yes. And I've always liked the way Jordan Peterson puts this. He said, look, you need to be able to speak in order to be able to know what you think. They're two parts of the same thing. If you can't say what's going on inside your head, then you can't work out what it is that you think. And so by regulating speech, they are in fact regulating your thoughts. And, and you know, if you have a government that is controlling your thinking, then you're not going to have any of those other things that you mentioned.
I agree. So Bruce, I did want to go at this issue from another angle as well. And honestly, I really encourage the audience to look at the bill, C-63, and speak up about it. But there's, I think, another angle, and that is the administrative state. And there's something particular I wanted to mention. And that was, I noticed that the Minister of Justice is not just simply the Minister of Justice now, but also the Attorney General. So when we think of the institution of justice, if you think of the one of the key roles of any state is to focus on the administration of justice. This isn't just simply, of course, the courts. It's also the Crown Prosecutor's Office. It's the police. And we have, would you not agree, an undermining of those roles? Like, these are very important roles. When you think of the Minister of Justice and Attorney General, historically they've been separated. I think the Donald Savoy, when he talks about Canadian institutions, has talked about this extensively. But does the merging of these two roles muddle and undermine justice in Canada?
Yeah, you raise a very interesting point. My take is that the answer there probably is yes. There's been a debate about this, but for my money, I think I'm on your page, David. It makes it difficult for the one person to wear these two hats, which are of course related roles, but they're not the same thing at all. To provide, so we all know that famous phrase that justice must not only be done, but must manifestly appear to be done. And when you when you have the same person doing these two sometimes conflicting roles, one being the Minister of Justice, who's, you know, preparing programs and legislation and acting on behalf of government, and also the Attorney General, who is the nominal head of the enforcement, you know, mechanism of the government. That becomes, I think, problematic in the way that you're describing.
Okay, so then the other layer of this, and I think we have a clip regarding this. It's a very particular clip I was able to find. It's a statement by the Minister of Justice and the Attorney General. And it's very interesting. I think we have that available. And if we could play that, I'd appreciate it. And perhaps we don't. This is a clip that was stated by the Minister of Justice and Attorney General. And it was in the context of supporting a United Nations toolkit on the law. And the toolkit is being, if memory serves me correctly, is being advocated by this Minister of Justice, Attorney General of Canada. And he speaks eloquently about the toolkit as being based on intersectionality, Bruce.
Yes, I've seen the clip. Yeah.
On culture.
Right.
On cultural Marxism. So advocating this as a toolkit, a lens, if you will,
right,
to implement the law so that those who have been oppressed can find voice. Now, I encourage people to look at that clip and we'll try to share it. But Bruce, what is going on here? This sounds like a different, totally different ideological lens to apply the law.
Well, yes, but it's become the dominant lens. And you can see that in the way that our human rights law has evolved. So people think if you look at any provincial human rights code, for example, there often is there a statement that everybody has the right to be free from discrimination. But as time has gone on, the tribunals have told us, well, actually, that's not the case. You have to be the right kind of person, belonging to the right kinds of groups to be able to claim discrimination. And in fact, recently, the Ontario Tribunal came out and said in black and white that if you're white and non-racialized, then you can't claim discrimination. And so what we have there is just one of the pieces of this transition that I was describing from one paradigm to another, wherein in the quote old paradigm, you have the idea of equal treatment by the law, equal protections, blind justice. And the new version of that is not blind justice at all. It's justice that treats you differently in accordance with the group that you belong to. And how that treatment is crafted depends upon your intersectionality, as the justice minister was alluding to, meaning that the rules will be adjusted so as to provide you with the freedom from oppression that their theory says that you are suffering from. And that means that for my money, that the foundation of the legal system that we all think exists, I mean, we all think as a given that justice is blind, that the law will be applied to us in the same way as everybody else. Okay.
Okay. So
that is no longer true. Yeah.
Yeah. So that assumption is no longer true that we have Lady Justice blind. Rather, this has been emerging for some time, this alien philosophy that somehow the purpose of the law is to go in and create equal outcomes. It's this whole notion that there's a collective kind of Marxist outcome that's needed to deal with oppression.
And you'll see how this dovetails with the idea of management, right? So the idea that you know, the relationships between people, depending upon your group and intersectionality and so on, needs to be crafted and manipulated. This is social management, and it is endless. It is endless because it's never fixed in the way that you know one would admit to. So it gives a mandate to government and to the legal system to interfere endlessly in a way that would not be the case if what we had was clear rules that applied to everybody in the same way and adjudicated objectively.
Done. Okay, so this would explain how this bill, C-63, is really a symptom of a much deeper problem.
Exactly.
It's a symptom of a much deeper problem.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so we're going to switch gears a little bit to something that is perhaps related, and that is the BC co-management scheme that was introduced, and I came across it, I think it was just 3 weeks ago. I mean, there's been a lot of foreshadows of this, if you will, the whole idea that we have all this crown land, and so some 95% of BC is crown land. But I do want to share this clip with you that introduces this topic.
Just we'll start off on the Land Act, which is something we don't really even often hear anything about, but some out of nowhere changes proposed in a very fast timeline here have raised some concerns. Basically, this law governs crown land, that 95% of the province that people apply for permits in 10 years to do things like hunt and camp and fish and log and mine and swim and stuff like that. Decisions made by a minister on what we can do. Now the government wants to create co-decision-making models with indigenous governments. Some people are concerned that might lead to land access and so-called veto issues, which we can get into. That word is pretty loaded too. So a lot to break down there. Ali, let's start with you. Feels like a lot of this criticism starts because nobody's really heard about these proposed legislative changes, which are apparently going to happen this spring. Let's start there.
Well, that's the big issue. So we should be afraid of how the NDP has rolled this out so secretively. And I'm glad we're talking about it because this might actually be the only awareness that our viewers are going to get about it. And this is absolutely on purpose by the NDP. The NDP are pulling a fast one on us. And before anyone says that like this is anti-Indigenous, that is exactly what the NDP want, to make this divisive with accusations that aren't real. But the engagement process isn't real, and that's the big red flag. This is ludicrous when we think about a massive drought coming our way this year, and now we risk water access instability. I've been talking about this potential drought for a while now, mostly because in Alberta, Minister Rebecca Schultz has been talking about this in a significant way. And so we're not immune to those challenges that are coming our way as well. But here's the most important thing. the NDP are being very cavalier with our democracy on this issue. So even if you don't think that this is an issue that will impact your life, like obviously like land use, it doesn't impact your life for a lot of things. It already has by letting them get away with this without proper debate and consultation. And so, but there's a difference between talking about taking action and removing the voter from the process altogether.
All right, so that's a clip of part of the analysis here, but basically the government of the day, just a matter of 3 or 4 weeks ago, took out a little ad saying we're going to make these big changes to the Land Act, and they had actually presentations about this, and I actually did have the chance to read it because I'd heard about it, quickly got on it, and it looked to me like it was profound. It said consent, consent, consent around Crown land between obviously the province of BC, but also First Nations. And then all of a sudden, there was a column in the Vancouver Sun by Vaughn Palmer, and then it just started mushrooming, and people are concerned about this issue of consent, saying, no, wait a sec, this is a veto. This is going to put our province back. You had opposition leaders striking in, and then all of a sudden, these presentations were taken off the website, and then just last week, the BC government withdrew and said, no, no, this is an overreaction. No, no. And by the way, this fall is going to be an election. So what's happening, Bruce? What's your take on this issue? Is this a veto or what's going on?
Oh, it would have been a veto, sure. I mean, so those materials that you're describing, the proposal was to enter into agreements with First Nations on a joint decision-making model or consent model. I'm not sure what the difference between those two things is, but those two things both describe a veto. So we know that because if you have a contract with somebody that requires both of your approval before something goes forward, then if either one of you says no, it doesn't go forward. And the same with consent. If some activity requires your consent and you don't give it, then the activity doesn't happen. That means a veto. That's what it means. So
the duck walking and talking again, this is a veto.
Of course it's a veto. But the commentary that we heard on the clip, I think, was quite right. But there's a very important point that we shouldn't miss here. That this all derives from legislation in BC that is already passed. They were going to amend the Land Act to provide for these agreements. And that proposal, for the time being, has been withdrawn. But the real problem is in the statute that's already been passed. It's called the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People Act. Indeed. In BC, it was passed in 2019 unanimously.
Wow.
And that act basically says the government, the BC government, shall do whatever is necessary to make BC law compliant with the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. And that declaration, which is a UN General Assembly declaration, basically says, well, it says all kinds of crazy things. But one of the things that it says is that First Nations, own, control, and use, et cetera, all the lands and resources that they traditionally, ever used, or words to that effect.
Wow.
And so what you have in already, right now, in BC law, is a mandate for the government to do exactly as it proposed to do. And this was one of the reactions that the NDP government gave to the pushback on this. I don't know if it was genuine or not, but they said, what's the problem? We already passed a statute and everybody voted for it. And it said we were going to do this.
We're just implementing UNDRIP.
And they have a point. And the point is that nobody was paying attention when this 2019 statute was put in place. All of the opposition members of the legislature voted in favor of it too. Wow. Presumably because they didn't think they were serious. And this is one of the mistakes that we've been making over and over again with respect to this statute, with respect to the Online Harms Act and the other. Wow. It's like, oh, well, they can't possibly mean that.
Yeah.
They mean it. They mean it. You should take the words as they are given and take them Seriously. And so
yeah,
this problem in BC is not over just because they withdrew the plan. Mm-hmm. The mandate is still in place and the problem is not fixed. Well, there's all kinds of things that have to change in BC. But the first thing I think is that BC statute, now called DRIPA, the Declaration on the Rights mm-hmm. of the Indigenous People Act, that statute needs to be repealed. Until it is, the problem still exists.
Wow. So it has not gone away as much as the current BC government before this fall election has, quote, withdrawn it. It hasn't. So help us understand, why does this matter to British Columbians? By the way, you can't supposedly use that term anymore. But why does this matter to them, but also Canadians, Bruce? Like, what can you give us an example why this would really matter to
sure.
us?
Sure. So, okay. So here's another idea that people have in their heads. That's from an old set of ideas, which is that your property is yours, mm-hmm. right? And because it's your property, you're sort of protected from interference with the property. And also that your province is yours. And you probably have a legitimate expectation to be able to use your province. If you put in your papers in the right way, that they'll approve you, your application for a permit or for a lease because it's your province and you've complied with the rules. Mm-hmm. That's not the way things are going now. Mm-hmm. Property is that they're turning property into a liability instead of an asset. How do we know that? Mm. Well, look at the kinds of taxes now they're putting in place. If you own like a second home in Vancouver, you're going to have to pay a vacant house tax.
Mm. Wow. Okay.
And so on and so forth. The property taxes are increasing and so on. And the fact that 95% of BC is Crown land means that that land is subject to the management of the government. And they can decide to give out permits and rights of way and leases and so on whatever criteria they decide. And just because up until now, it's been pretty straightforward, and as you might expect, that doesn't mean it's going to continue to be. And so you could almost make the case that the BC government doesn't need to make these kinds of legislative changes to the Land Act. They already have the authority to approve or not approve your applications. They might just go ahead and do this without the amendments.
Wow. This is stunning. So I'm talking with Professor Bruce Pardee at Queen's University. He's also the executive director of Rights Probe. Be sure to look at his website. But we're talking about the so-called changes to the BC's Land Act regarding some call a veto. Within a kind of a co-management scheme where First Nations would, in effect, have a veto. So I will tell you an interesting story, Bruce. When this story broke, I got a call from a friend who's really involved in the BC economy, builds a lot of houses. Mm-hmm. And I took your column, among other background information. It's dated... it's February 22nd. It's in the Epoch Times. I encourage people to watch, to look at it. And he called me up and said, Dave, I want to talk about this. And he said, you know, I am vitally concerned. This is a person who's had a long history in the province, has made an incredible contribution, great salt of the earth person. He said, you know what? If this passes, I'm pretty well done. I don't see a future for this province. So, you know, not to sound overly dramatic, but this sounds like another wake-up call where these things are stated and based on years ago of direction and planning and orchestration. And now we're finally seeing this like an iceberg come up out of the water, and we're seeing what the real game here is. So am I being too cynical about this, Bruce, or are we actually seeing before our eyes the total undermining of both freedom of speech, property rights, you name it, and this isn't the Canada that we look up to anymore?
That is correct. That is correct. And as you allude to, it's been in process for a long time, and people just haven't been ready to confront it. But, you know, you it's an overused metaphor, but it is like the frog in boiling water. You know, and so when it reaches boiling point, you really shouldn't be surprised.
And see, ironically, you know what the minister involved here, and I forget his title exactly. I think it's something regarding the Minister of Water, Land, and Resource Stewardship. This minister of the BC government said, there is no veto on these amendments. He told the Nanaimo News Bulletin last week. He accused critics of fear-mongering and misinformation. There's those words again, misinformation. My worry is that for some of the political actors here on the right, this is an element of dog whistle politics. Wow.
Right.
So, gosh, he's going to be in favor of that online censorship act that we just spoke about, because he'll want to say, Bruce Pardee, we got to lock him up because he's gonna write more columns like this. Is this what it's about?
Essentially, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's right, and so on those comments about the dog whistle politics and the veto and so on. I mean, this is disingenuous, right? Those comments are, I think, from what I could tell from the comments that were published, is trying to split hairs with technicalities. So one of the things that the minister said was, when a First Nations governing body makes a decision about one of these things jointly with the government, that decision is subject to judicial review. If somebody wants to take it and take it to a court and review it, they can do that. And therefore, it's not a final say, and therefore it's not a veto. Okay. Well, but that's ridiculous, because all statutory decisions made by government officials can be taken to a court for judicial review. That doesn't mean they're not final decisions. And the courts generally defer to those decisions. And even if they find some kind of procedural or substantive problem with them that is, quote, unreasonable, the decision's not changed. It's just sent back to be done again most of the time. And so if we are to accept the idea that the First Nations call on these things is not a veto, and because it's not a final decision, what he's saying is, as the minister, well, I don't really have a veto either. I don't really have a final decision either, because there's always the courts. That's pure jibber jabber. That's just ridiculous.
Wow. Yeah. So this is again another train wreck, I'd say, another assault on basic rights and freedom. So we've got to really keep our eyes on that one. But obviously it's going to be in the context of an election. If that government, I don't mean this in a partisan way, is reelected with a majority, then that's probably good as done. That action.
I
don't have a crystal ball, but that's probably what they'll do, is just reintroduce it.
I would have thought. I who knows what will happen for sure, but that would make a lot of sense. I have half a suspicion that they might decide to do it a different way. The statute that I referred to, DRIPA, the one that's already been passed, actually authorizes the cabinet to authorize a government official like the minister to go off and do these things already. It doesn't say you have to amend the other statutes. It says cabinet can authorize you. So whether or not they actually need to amend the Land Act, I'm not sure if that is the case or not, but it's possible they might find a different route to the same result.
Okay. So on that note, and just to be a little bit of a devil's advocate, so Bruce, I thought the United Nations is such an honorable group of people. We should all be climbing on board with their globalist perspective. We're all one world, one humanity, as we join hands and sing the song. Why aren't we getting on board with that agenda, Bruce? Surely you agree with the United Nations.
Well, the United Nations has turned out to be a massive mistake. It's a global bureaucracy where nothing is transparent and nothing is accountable, and they have put in place these declarations and schemes and objectives which are in conflict with the basic principles that we thought that we had in our governance and in our laws. Right. And the best thing that we could do right now, see, the UN, let's go back a step. For my money, the original conception of the UN was to be a meeting place mm-hmm. for countries to gather and try and work out their differences. That was a good idea. Better to mm-hmm. have that than war. But it's taken on an identity, and in fact, has also been captured, if you like, by countries and by forces that do not have our interests at heart. And so the mm-hmm. best thing I think that we could do now, frankly, is to disentangle ourselves from the UN Indeed. And its associated yes. bodies like the World Health Organization. They're not mm-hmm. doing us any good at all. And I would prefer to be completely out of it.
I would vote for you, Bruce. I think you make a lot of very good points. The UN is dominated, ironically, by what is it called again? Oh, yes, totalitarian regimes
right.
that don't yep. really share our values as much as we want to get along with everyone around the world. And I think the other side to this is that we do have a sovereign national state within a democratic set of rules, including the rule of law, that enables us to, as a people, have a voice. And I think that's a beautiful thing. So why would you give that up to some other people at some UN headquarters is beyond me.
Well, I think it serves the purposes of our own political class.
Ah, yes.
Right? Because one of the things that they can do is they can sign on to these UN things and mm-hmm. then behave as though those mandates tie their hands. And they really don't have any choice because, after all, it's a customary international norm, or it's a term of the treaty mm-hmm. that they all agreed to. And we really have to be part of the treaty because everybody else is too. But, and so they're really sorry, but, you know, this is the way it has to be. That's total nonsense. But,
exactly.
but it's a convenient smokescreen for what they want to do anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant insight. It's almost like the big workaround. You're dealing with a group of elites that don't necessarily believe in democracy.
Oh, no, absolutely true. Absolutely true. They are of the managerial class. And the managerial class regards the rule of law as a mere inconvenience that really can be set aside whenever the conditions dictate. And so, which is partly why we don't really have one anymore. We have rule by law instead of rule of law. And that's a function of this class of people trying to do what the rule of law would prevent them from doing, which is making stuff up as they go.
No, I think, Bruce, you've summarized the issue brilliantly. And certainly we saw that during COVID-19 in spades, where they were making it up as they were going along and at great harm to society, like the impact of lockdowns on everyone, including children and businesses. I mean, it's just astounding what they did. And all in the so-called name of science, of all things. I mean, it's just incredible. So Bruce, I can't help but, before we kind of get to the home stretch here, reflect a little bit on some really fantastic news. And that was the decision that the invocation, the use of the Emergencies Act was illegal. What did you think about that? Is that not great news?
It's great news. It's great news. My hat's off to the judge for the job that he did. And you know, so the reason that the case is special is because it wasn't special in the sense that the judge did the job he was supposed to do, right?
Yes.
So he took the statute. The statute has requirements. He read the requirements. He interpreted what the requirements meant. He compared those requirements to the facts and said, doesn't fit. And that's what judges are supposed to do.
Exactly.
And so it was a straight up decision. It had a couple of odd things in the decision, but nevertheless, it was a good piece of work. Now, of course, the government, as you would expect, has said they're appealing it. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that things will go well. The judge's decision basically came to four conclusions, and in order for the government to prevail on appeal completely, they would really have to overturn all four of those conclusions. So I'm hoping that things will be difficult for that to happen, but we'll see.
No, I agree. Bravo to was it Judge Mosley?
Mosley, correct. Yes.
Mosley. I thought that was brilliant. I encourage people to read the decision. I know it's a long one. I think it was 199 pages, but it's, I chuckle when you say, Bruce, it was, dare I say, a normal decision that you'd kind of expect. So that was refreshing in itself. So I think it's really a great green shoot of hope that we can look to. So, but this has been a terrific discussion, Bruce, and I really appreciate your analysis and leadership and courage. So we'll have to have you back soon as we keep catching up with these train wrecks or eruptions as they come forward, because we really need your help, among others, to speak up as Canadians. We cannot take these rights and freedoms for granted. So thank you so much, Bruce.
Oh, thank you, David. Always great to be with you, and keep up the great work.
Well, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for joining us, the audience. And we welcome your comments and feedback. And be sure to join us again next week. And please like and share what you've seen today. This is important. So please get it out there and share the news. Thank you so much.